"We're forced to upset you a little, Margarita Nikolaevna, and Master," began Volant after a brief pause. "But please don't hold a grudge. I don't think you'll have any cause for regret." "Well, then," he said, addressing the Master alone, "say goodbye to the city. It's time for us to go." Volant pointed a black-gloved hand toward the other side of the river, where countless suns were smelting the glass, and where the sky over these suns was thick with mist, smoke, and the steam from the city left incandescent by the day's heat. The Master dismounted quickly, detached himself from the group, and ran over to the precipice of the hill. His black cloak trailed behind him on the ground. The Master began to look at the city. In the first few seconds, an aching sadness wrenched his heart. But it soon gave way to a feeling of sweet disquiet, the excitement of gypsy wanderlust. "Forever. That must be fully comprehended," whispered the Master, and he licked his dry, cracked lips. He began to listen carefully and pay close attention to everything that was happening in his soul. His excitement, it seemed to him, had turned into a feeling of deep and deadly resentment. But it was short-lived. It passed, and gave way, for some reason, to a feeling of proud indifference, which, in turn, became a presentiment of permanent peace. The group of riders waited for the Master in silence. The group of riders watched the gesticulations of the long black figure at the edge of the precipice, who at times raised his head as if trying to encompass the whole city with his gaze and peer beyond its boundaries, and at others dropped his head as if studying the stunted, trampled grass beneath his feet. The silence was broken by Behemoth, who had become bored.
"May I have permission, maître," he said, "to give a whistle of farewell before we ride off?"
"You might frighten the lady," replied Volant. "And besides, don't forget that today's disgraceful antics are over now."
"Oh, no, no, monsieur," said Margarita, sitting in the saddle like an Amazon, her hand on her hip, her pointed train reaching down to the ground. "Give him permission to whistle. Thinking about the long road ahead makes me sad. That's natural, isn't it, monsieur? Even when you know that happiness awaits you at the end of the road. Let him make us laugh, or else I'm afraid this will all end in tears, and everything will be spoiled before we set out on the road."
Volant nodded to Behemoth, who got very animated, jumped off his horse, put his fingers in his mouth, puffed out his cheeks, and whistled. Margarita's ears began ringing. Her horse reared up. Dry branches broke off in the grove. Flocks of ravens and sparrows flew up into the sky. A column of dust spiraled towards the river, and several of the passengers on a riverboat that was going past the landing below had their caps blown off into the water. The whistle made the Master shudder. However, he did not turn around, but began gesticulating even more wildly, raising his fist skyward as if he were threatening the city. Behemoth looked around proudly.
"That was a real whistle, I won't argue," remarked Korovyov condescendingly. "A real whistle, but objectively speaking, it was pretty mediocre." "Well, I'm not a choir master," replied Behemoth with dignity, puffing himself up and unexpectedly giving Margarita a wink. "Let me give it a try, if I can remember how," said Korovyov, rubbing his hands and blowing on his fingers.
"But just be careful," said Volant, sternly from astride his horse. "No broken limbs."
"Believe me, monsieur," rejoined Korovyov, his hand pressed to his heart. "It's just for fun, I assure you."
Whereupon he stretched as if he were made of rubber, twirled the fingers of his right hand in an ingenious way, twisted himself up like a corkscrew, and then, after suddenly unwinding, let out a whistle. Margarita did not hear the whistle, but she saw its effects when she and her fiery steed were thrown more than 20 yards to the side. An oak tree next to her was torn up by the roots, and fissures spread over the ground to the river.
A huge chunk of riverbank, together with the landing and the restaurant, was uprooted into the river. The water bubbled and heaved, and an entire riverboat was thrown up on the green low-lying opposite shore, the passengers completely unharmed. A jackdaw, killed by Fagot's whistle, landed at the feet of Margarita's neighing horse. This whistle scared the master away. He grabbed his head and ran back to join his waiting companions.
"Well, then," said Voland, addressing him from atop his horse, "are all your accounts settled? Have you completed your farewell?"
"Yes, I have," replied the master, and having regained his composure, he looked boldly and squarely into Voland's face. And then the terrifying voice of Voland boomed over the hills like a trumpet call.
"Time to go!" followed by the sharp whistle and laughter of Behemoth.
The horses set off, and the riders soared upwards, breaking into a gallop. Margarita could feel her frenzied horse chomping and straining at the bit. Voland's cloak billowed out over the heads of the entire cavalcade and began filling the vault of the evening sky. When the black covering moved aside for just an instant, Margarita, still galloping, looked back over her shoulder and saw that everything behind them was gone. Not only the multicolored towers with the airplane whirring overhead, but the city itself, which had vanished into the ground and left only mist in its wake.
Chapter 32. Absolution and Eternal Refuge.
Gods, my gods, how sad the earth is at eventide. How mysterious are the mists over the swamps. Anyone who has wandered in these mists, who has suffered a great deal before death or flown above the earth bearing a burden beyond his strength, knows this. Someone who is exhausted knows this. And without regret he forsakes the mists of the earth, its swamps and rivers, and sinks into the arms of death with a light heart, knowing that death alone. Even the magical black horses had tired and were carrying their riders slowly, and the inevitable night was beginning to catch up with them. Sensing the knight at his back, even the irrepressible Behemoth had fallen silent and was flying along, serious and silent, his claws dug into his saddle, his tail fluffed out behind him. Night began covering the forests and meadows with its black kerchief. The night ignited sad little lights somewhere far below, alien lights, that were no longer of any interest or use either to Margarita or the master. Night overtook the cavalcade, spreading over them from above and scattering white specks of stars here and there in the saddened sky. Night was thickening, flying alongside the riders, grabbing at their cloaks and pulling them off, unmasking all illusions. And whenever Margarita, buffeted by the cool breeze, opened her eyes, she saw the changes that were taking place in the appearances of all who were flying to their destination. And when the crimson full moon rose up to meet them from behind the edge of the forest, all illusions vanished, and the magical, mutable clothing fell into the swamp and drowned in the mist. Karavyov, Fagot, the self-titled interpreter for the mysterious consultant who never required any interpretation, was hardly recognizable now in the figure who was flying beside Voland to the right of the master's beloved. In place of the fellow who had left Sparrow Hills in a torn circus outfit under the name of Korovyov Fagot, there now galloped, his gold reins clinking softly, a dark, violet knight with an extremely somber face that never smiled. He flew along beside Voland, with his chin on his chest, not looking at the moon and taking no interest in the earth below, but rather completely immersed in his own thoughts.
"Why is he so changed?" Margarita softly asked Voland to the whistling of the wind. "That knight once made a joke that fell flat," replied Voland, turning his quietly smoldering eye toward Margarita. "While conversing about darkness and light, he made up a pun that was not entirely satisfactory. And after that he was forced to work a bit longer and harder at making his jokes than he imagined. But tonight is the kind of night when accounts are settled. The knight has paid his bill and closed his account." Knight had also torn off Behemoth's fluffy tail, stripped him of his fur, and scattered clumps of it over the swamps. The one who had been the cat who amused the Prince of Darkness turned out to be a lean youth, a demon page, the best jester the world has ever known. Now he too had fallen silent and was flying noiselessly, his young face raised to the light flowing from the moon. Over to the side of the rest, the steel of his armor gleaming, flew Azazello. The moon had transformed his face as well. The absurd ugly fang was gone, and the blind eye turned out to have been fake. Both Azazello's eyes were alike, empty and black, and his face was cold and white. Azazello was now flying in his true aspect as the demon of the waterless desert, the demon killer. Margarita could not see herself, but she could certainly see how the master had changed. His hair looked white in the moonlight and was gathered behind him in a queue that flew in the wind. Whenever the wind blew the master's cloak away from his legs, Margarita could see the stars flickering on the spurs of his jackboots. Like the demon youth, the master flew with his eyes fixed on the moon, but he was smiling at it as if it were someone he knew and loved. And he was mumbling to himself, a habit acquired in room 118. And finally, Voland, too, was flying in his true aspect. Margarita could not have said what his horse's reins were made of, and thought they might have been moonbeam chains. And his horse, just a clump of darkness, and the horse's mane, a cloud, and the rider's spurs, the white specks of stars. They flew in silence like that for a long time, until the landscape below began to change. The mournful forests drowned in the darkness of the earth, taking with them the dull blades of the rivers. Down below, boulders appeared and began giving off reflections, and in between the boulders were gaps of blackness where the moonlight could not penetrate. Voland set his horse down on a stony, joyless, flat summit, and then the riders went forward at a walk, listening to the clop of their horses' hooves on the stones and pieces of flint. The moon flooded the area with a bright green light, and in the deserted expanse, Margarita could make out an armchair, and in it, the white figure of a seated man. The seated figure appeared to be either deaf or too sunk in thought. He did not hear the ground trembling under the weight of the horses, nor was he disturbed by the approaching riders. The moon was a great help to Margarita. It gave better light than the most powerful electric street lamp, and Margarita saw that the seated figure, whose eyes seemed blind, was spasmodically rubbing his hands and gazing with unseeing eyes at the disk of the moon. Now Margarita could see that next to the heavy stone chair, which seemed to sparkle in the moonlight, there lay a huge dark dog, with pointed ears, who, like his master, was gazing anxiously at the moon. At the feet of the seated figure were shards of a broken jug and a blackish-red puddle that would never dry up. The riders stopped their horses. "They have read your novel," began Voland, turning to the master. "And they said only one thing, that, unfortunately, it is not finished. So I wanted to show you your hero. He has been sitting here for about 2,000 years, sleeping, but when the moon is full he is tormented, as you see, by insomnia. And it torments not only him, but his faithful guardian, the dog. If it is true that cowardice is the most grave vice, then the dog at least is not guilty of it. The only thing that brave creature ever feared was thunderstorms. But what can be done? The one who loves must share the fate
of the one he loves.
"What is he saying?" asked Margarita, and her utterly tranquil face was covered by a veil of compassion.
"He says," Volan's voice rang out, "the same thing over and over, that the moon gives him no peace, and that he has a bad job. That is what he always says when he cannot sleep. And when he does sleep, he always sees the same thing, a path of moonlight, and he wants to walk on that path and talk with the prisoner Hanotsri because, as he keeps maintaining, he did not finish what he wanted to say long ago, on the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan. But alas, for some reason he never does manage to walk on the path, and no one comes to see him. So there is nothing for him to do except talk to himself. Some variety is necessary, however. So when he talks about the moon, he frequently adds that he hates his immortality and unprecedented fame more than anything in the world. He maintains that he would gladly change places with the ragged wanderer, Levi Matvei."
12,000 moons for that one moon long ago. Isn't that too much?" asked Margarita.
"Is this that story with Frida all over again?" said Voland. "But in this case, Margarita, you need not upset yourself. Everything will be made right. That is what the world is built on."
"Let him go!" suddenly shouted Margarita piercingly, just as she had shouted when she was a witch. And her cry dislodged a boulder on the mountainside and sent it hurtling down the slopes into the abyss with a thunderous crash. But Margarita could not tell whether it was the crash of the boulder she heard or the thunder of satanic laughter. In any event, Volant was laughing as he looked at Margarita and said, "One must not shout when in the mountains. Anyway, he's used to avalanches, and it won't disturb him. You need not plead for him, Margarita, because the one he wants to talk with already has." Volant again turned to the master and said, "Well, then, now you can finish your novel with a single sentence." The master seemed to have been waiting for this as he stood motionless, looking at the seated procurator. He cupped his hands over his mouth like a megaphone and shouted so that the echo rebounded over the desolate and treeless mountains, "Free! Free! He is waiting for you!" The mountains transformed the master's voice into thunder, and the thunder destroyed them. The accursed rocky walls caved in. The only thing that remained was the summit with the stone chair. Above the black abyss where the walls had vanished blazed a vast city dominated by glittering idols that towered over a garden gone luxuriantly to seed during these thousands of moons. The path of moonlight, long awaited by the procurator, led right up to the garden, and the dog with the pointed ears was the first to rush out on it. The man in the white cloak with the blood-red lining got up from his chair and shouted something in a hoarse, broken voice. It was impossible to make out whether he was laughing or crying, or what he was shouting, but he could be seen running down the path of moonlight after his faithful guardian. "Is that where I'm to go?" asked the master anxiously, touching his reins.
"No," replied Volant. "Why pursue that which is already finished?"
"Does that mean back there, then?" asked the master, who turned and pointed back to where the city they had just left displayed itself with its gingerbread monastery towers and its sun broken to smithereens in the glass.
"Not there either," replied Volant, and his voice thickened and began to flow over the cliffs. "Romantic master, the one whom the hero you created and just released so yearned to see has read your novel."
Here Volant turned to Margarita and said, "Margarita Nikolaevna,
it is impossible not to believe that you tried to devise the best possible future for the master. But I assure you that what I am offering you and what Yeshua has requested for you is better still."
"Let the two of them be alone," said Volant, leaning across his saddle over to the master's saddle and pointing toward the departed procurator.
"Let's not disturb them. Maybe they will come to some agreement."
Volant then waved his hand toward Yerushalayim, and it was extinguished.
"And there, too," said Volant, pointing backward. "What would you do in your little basement?"
The fragmented sun dimmed in the glass.
"Why go back?"
continued Volant in a firm and gentle voice.
"Oh, master, thrice a romantic! Wouldn't you like to stroll with your beloved under the blossoming cherry trees by day, and then listen to Schubert by night? Wouldn't it be nice for you to write by candlelight with a quill pen? Wouldn't you like to sit over a retort like Faust in the hope of creating a new homunculus? Go there! Go there, there where a house and an old servant already await you, where the candles are already burning but will soon go out because you are about to meet the dawn. Take that road, master, that one. Farewell. It is time for me to go."
"Farewell," shouted Margarita and the master in reply to Volant. Then the black Volant, forswearing all roads, plunged into the gap, and his retinue noisily rushed down after him. Nothing remained around them, not the cliffs, nor the summit, nor the path of moonlight, nor Yerushalayim. The black horses vanished as well. The master and Margarita saw the promised dawn. It began immediately, right after the midnight moon. In the radiance of the first rays of morning, the master and his beloved were walking over a small, moss-covered stone bridge. They crossed the bridge. The stream was left behind by the true lovers, and they walked along a sandy path.
"Listen to the silence,"
Margarita was saying to the master, the sand crunching under her bare feet.
"Listen and take pleasure in what you were not given in life. Quiet. Look, there up ahead is your eternal home, which you've been given as a reward. I can see the Venetian window and the grapevine curling up to the roof. There is your home, your eternal home. I know that in the evenings, people you like will come to see you, people who interest you and who will not upset you. They will play for you, sing for you, and you will see how the room looks in candlelight. You will fall asleep with your grimy, eternal cap on your head. You will fall asleep with a smile on your lips. Sleep will strengthen you. You will begin to reason wisely, and you will never be able to chase me away. I will guard your sleep."
Thus spoke Margarita, as she walked with the master toward their eternal home. And it seemed to the master that Margarita's words flowed like the stream they had left behind, flowed and whispered, and the master's anxious, needle-pricked memory began to fade. Someone was releasing the master into freedom, as he himself had released the hero he created. That hero, who was absolved on Sunday morning, had departed into the abyss, never to return, the son of an astrologer king, the cruel fifth procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate.
Epilogue. But still, what happened next in Moscow, after that Saturday evening at sunset when Volant and his retinue left the capital and disappeared from Sparrow Hills? It's pointless to speak of the preposterous rumors that buzzed loudly and long throughout the city and spread quickly to the most distant and remote parts of the provinces. It's even sickening to repeat them. The writer of these truthful lines has himself heard, while on a train to Feodosia, a story about how in Moscow 2,000 people walked out of a theater naked in the literal sense of the word, and then went home in taxis in the same state. Whispers of an evil power were heard in lines at dairy shops, in streetcars, stores, apartments, kitchens,
suburban and long-distance trains, at stations large and small, in dachas and on beaches. Needless to say, truly mature and cultured people did not tell these stories about an evil power's visit to the capital. In fact, they even made fun of them and tried to talk sense into those who told them. Nevertheless, facts are facts, as they say, and cannot simply be dismissed without explanation. Somebody had visited the capital. The charred cinders of Gribojedov alone, and many other things besides, confirmed that. Cultured people shared the point of view of the investigating team. It was the work of a gang of hypnotists and ventriloquists magnificently skilled in their art. Both inside Moscow and beyond, prompt and energetic steps were, of course, taken to ensure their capture, but most regrettably produced no results. The man who called himself Volant vanished along with his henchmen and never again returned to Moscow, nor did he ever show himself or make an appearance anywhere else. Quite naturally, there was speculation that he had escaped abroad, but he never showed up there either. The investigation of his case went on for a long time. Say what you will, it was certainly a hellish one. Apart from the four buildings burned to ashes, and the hundreds of people driven insane, there were also fatalities. Two were known for sure. Berlioz and that unfortunate civil servant in the Moscow Bureau of Sightseeing for Foreigners, the former Baron Maigil. Those two had certainly been killed. The charred bones of the latter had been discovered in apartment number 50 on Sadovaya Street after the fire had been put out. Yes, there had been victims, and that called for an investigation. But there were other victims as well, even after Volant had left the capital, and, sad to say, they were black cats. 100 or so of these peaceful animals, useful and devoted to man, were shot or otherwise destroyed in various parts of the country. More than a dozen of them, some in extremely mangled condition, were delivered to police stations in various cities. For example, a citizen in Armavir brought in one such innocent creature with its front paws tied up. The man had caught the cat just as the animal was looking furtive. So what can be done if that's the way cats look? It's not because they're guilty, but because they fear that creatures stronger than they, dogs or people, will harm them in some way. And that's not hard to do, but it's nothing to be proud of, I assure you. No, not at all. And yes, wearing such a furtive look, the cat was about to bound into a burdock patch for some reason. As the citizen pounced on the cat and tore off his tie in order to tie him up, he venomously and menacingly muttered, "Gotcha! So, Mr. Hypnotist, you've decided to pay us a little visit in Armavir, have you? Well, we're not afraid of you here, and don't pretend to be mute. We already know what a fine fellow you are." The citizen took the cat to the police station, dragging the poor creature by its front paws, which had been tied together with a green necktie, and giving it little kicks so it would walk on its hind legs. "Cut it out!" shouted the citizen as boys followed him, hooting, "Stop playing the fool, it won't work. Walk like everyone else." The black cat merely rolled its martyred eyes. Deprived by nature of the gift of speech, it had no way to defend itself. For its salvation, the poor beast was indebted, first of all, to the police, and secondly, to its mistress, a respected elderly widow. Once the cat was at the station, the policeman could see that the citizen who had brought it in reeked of alcohol, which immediately cast doubt on his testimony. Meanwhile, the widow, after learning from her neighbors that her cat had been hauled off, ran to the police station and managed to get there in time. She gave the cat the most flattering recommendation, explained that she had known it for 5 years, ever since it was a kitten, vouched for it as much as for herself, and proved that it had never been implicated in any misconduct and had never been to Moscow. It had been born and raised in Armavir, and had learned to catch mice there. The cat was untied and returned to its owner. After, it's true, having gotten a taste of trouble firsthand, a practical lesson in the meaning of mistaken identity and slander. Besides the cats, there were a few people who suffered some minor unpleasantness. Several arrests were made.
Among those held briefly in custody were citizens Volman and Volpir in Leningrad, three Volodyns in Saratov, Kiev, and Kharkov, a Voloch in Kazan, and in Penza, no one knows why, a doctoral candidate in chemistry named Vyachinkievich. True, he was enormously tall, dark-haired, and swarthy. In addition to the above, nine Korovins, four Korovkins, and a pair of Karavayevs were caught in various locales. At the station in Bielgorod, a certain citizen was taken off the Sevastopol train in handcuffs. This citizen had taken it into his head to entertain his fellow passengers with card tricks. In Yaroslavl, a man appeared in a restaurant just at dinner time carrying a Primus stove, which he had just retrieved from a repair shop. When the two doormen on duty spotted him in the cloakroom, they took off and ran out of the restaurant with all the patrons and staff following at their heels. During this, all the cashier's receipts mysteriously disappeared. A lot of other things happened, but one can't remember everything. There was great intellectual ferment. Again and again, one must give the investigators their due. Everything was done not only to catch the criminals, but to explain all their actions as well. And they were all explained, and one can't but concede that the explanations were both reasonable and irrefutable. Investigation spokesmen and experienced psychiatrists established that the criminal gang members, or perhaps one in particular, suspicion fell chiefly on Korovyov, were hypnotists with unprecedented powers, capable of appearing not where they actually were, but in illusory, displaced locations. In addition, they could easily convince whoever came in contact with them that certain objects or people were present in places where, really, they were not. And conversely, they could remove from sight those objects or people that actually were in sight. In the light of such explanations, everything became absolutely clear, even that which had disturbed the citizens the most, namely, the seemingly inexplicable invulnerability of the cat who had been riddled with bullets in apartment number 50 during the attempt to take him into custody. There had, of course, been no cat on the chandelier, and no one had even thought of returning his fire. They had been shooting into the air, while Korovyov, who had duped them into thinking that a cat was raising hell on the chandelier, could easily have been positioned behind those who were shooting, showing off and reveling in his own tremendous, if criminally misapplied, powers of suggestion. And it was he, of course, who had poured the kerosene around the apartment and set fire to it. Stjopa Likhodeyev had naturally not flown to any Yalta. Even Korovyov couldn't have pulled off a stunt like that. Nor had he sent any telegrams from there. After being tricked by Korovyov into seeing a cat with a pickled mushroom on his fork, and fainting with fright as a result, Stjopa had lain unconscious in the jeweler's widow's apartment until Korovyov, making a fool of him once again, had yanked a felt hat over his head and sent him off to the Moscow airport, having previously convinced CID members that Stjopa would get off the airplane arriving from Sevastopol. True, the Yalta CID maintained that they had taken the barefoot Stjopa into custody and had sent telegrams about him to Moscow, but not one copy of those telegrams were ever found in the files, which led to the sad but utterly unshakable conclusion that the band of hypnotists was able to practice long-distance hypnosis and not just on individuals, but on whole groups of people at one time. This being the case, the criminals were able to drive the most mentally stable people out of their minds. Why bother mentioning, therefore, such things as the deck of cards that turned up in the pocket of some stranger in the audience, the lady's clothing that vanished, or the meowing beret, and other such things? Any professional hypnotist of average ability can perform tricks like that on any stage. And that includes the simple trick of tearing off the MC's head. The talking cat was also downright nonsense. All you need to get such a cat to perform is an elementary knowledge of ventriloquism. And no one could seriously doubt that Korovyov's skills went far beyond the basics. No, the decks of cards or the forged letters in Nikanor Ivanovich's briefcase were not the issue. Those were mere trifles. And it was he, Korovyov, who had pushed Berlioz to certain death under the streetcar.
It was he who had driven the poor poet, Ivan Bezdomny, out of his mind, he who had made him imagine things and have tormenting dreams about ancient Yerushalayim and about sun-scorched, arid, bald mountain with its three men hanged on posts. It was he and his gang who had made Margarita Nikolaevna and her maid, the beautiful Natasha, disappear from Moscow. Incidentally, the investigators had given this matter special attention. They had to determine whether the women had been abducted by the gang of murderers and arsonists, or whether they had run off with a criminal band of their own free will. Based on the absurd and muddled testimony of Nikolai Ivanovich, and taking into account the bizarre and insane note Margarita Nikolaevna had left her husband, in which she said she had gone off to be a witch, and considering the fact that Natasha had disappeared without taking any of her things, the investigators concluded that mistress and maid had both been hypnotized, along with so many others, and abducted by the gang while in that state. The quite likely possibility also arose that the criminals had been attracted by the women's beauty. However, the motive behind the gang's abduction of a mental patient calling himself the master from a psychiatric clinic still remained a mystery for the investigators. They could not find an explanation for that, nor could they learn the name of the abducted patient. Thus, he vanished into the files under the lifeless tag number 118 from Block 1. And so, almost everything was explained, and the investigation came to an end, just as, in general, all things do. Several years passed, and the citizens began to forget about Volant, Korovyov, and the others. Many changes took place in the lives of the victims of Volant and his associates, and however petty and insignificant those changes may have been, they still deserve mention. Georgi Biangolsky, for example, recovered and went home after a 3-month stay in the hospital, but he was forced to give up his job at the Variety Theater, and at the most hectic time, when the public rushed the theater for tickets, memories of black magic and its exposés were still too fresh in his mind. Biangolsky gave up the Variety because he realized that to appear every evening before 2,000 people, to be inevitably recognized and endlessly subjected to snide questions about whether he preferred having his head on or off, was too painful for him. Yes, and besides that, the MC had lost a sizable portion of the cheerfulness necessary for his line of work. He was left with the unpleasant and burdensome habit of falling into a state of anxiety every spring during the full moon, when he would suddenly grab at his neck, look around fearfully, and weep. Although these attacks passed quickly, they made it impossible for him to work at his former job, so he went into retirement and began living on his savings, which, according to his modest calculations, would last him for 15 years. He left, and never again saw Varenuha, who had won universal popularity and affection for his incredibly polite and considerate attitude toward others, rare even among theater managers. Recipients of complimentary passes, for example, regarded him as a father benefactor. Whoever called the Variety Theater at whatever time of day or night was always greeted by a soft but sad voice that said, "How can I help you?" And when Varenuha was called to the phone, that same voice would readily reply, "I'm at your service." But Ivan Savelyevich's courteousness had brought him suffering. Stiopeli Khodeyev no longer has to talk on the phone at the Variety. After being discharged from the clinic where he spent 8 days, Stiopa was transferred to Rostov, where he was appointed manager of a large specialty food store. Rumor has it that he has sworn off port completely, and drinks only vodka steeped in black currants, which has greatly improved his health. They say that he has become taciturn and avoids women. Stepan Bogdanovich's removal from the Variety did not give Rimsky the joy he so fervently dreamed of for so long. After a spell in the clinic and a rest cure at Kislovodsk, the aged and decrepit financial director with the shaking head put in for retirement from the Variety. Interestingly, it was his wife who turned in his retirement application to the theater. Even in daylight,
Grigory Danilovich did not have the strength to be in the same building where he had seen the cracked windowpane flooded with moonlight and the long arm feeling its way along the lower latch. After retiring from the Variety, the financial director joined the Children's Puppet Theater in Zamoskvoretzhye. There he was no longer forced to deal with the esteemed Arkady Apollonovich Sempliyarov in regard to acoustical matters. The latter had been speedily transferred to Bryansk and made the head of a mushroom processing plant. Now Muscovites eat his salted saffron milk caps and marinated white mushrooms, praise them to the skies, and could not be more delighted about his transfer. What's past is past, and it can now be said that Arkady Apollonovich's performance in acoustics was never really a success, and no matter how hard he tried to make improvements in acoustics, they still remained the same. Besides Arkady Apollonovich, Nikanor Ivanovich Bosoy should be included among those who severed their ties with the theater, although the only connection between Nikanor Ivanovich and the theater was his fondness for free passes. Not only does Nikanor Ivanovich not attend the theater, either with a paid ticket or a free pass, his face actually changes whenever the theater is even mentioned. Besides the theater, his hatred for the poet Pushkin and for the gifted actor Sava Potapovich Korolyesov has increased rather than diminished. He hates the latter so much that last year, when he saw a black-bordered announcement in the paper to the effect that Sava Potapovich had died of a stroke at the height of his career, Nikanor Ivanovich got so red in the face that he almost followed in Sava Potapovich's footsteps. And then he let out a roar, "Serves him right!" That same evening, moreover, Nikanor Ivanovich, for whom the popular actor's death brought such a flood of painful memories, went all by himself, with only the full moon over Sadovaya Street for company, and got roaring drunk. With each glass he drank, the accursed list of people he detested grew longer and longer, and on it were Sergei Gerardovich Dunchil, the beautiful Ida Gyerkulanovna, the red-haired owner of the Fighting Geese, and the outspoken Nikolai Kanavkin. Well, so what happened to all of them? Mercy me, absolutely nothing happened to them, nor could it have, since they never existed in reality, just as the likable MC never existed, nor the theater itself, nor the old skinflint aunt Porokhovnikova, who let foreign currency rot in her cellar, nor, of course, did the gold trumpets and the insolent cooks. Nikanor Ivanovich had just dreamed it all under the influence of that rogue Korovyov. The only living person in the dream had been Sava Potapovich, the actor, and he had gotten into the dream just because he had been on the radio so much that he stuck in Nikanor Ivanovich's memory. He did exist, but the others did not. So maybe Aloisi Mogarich did not exist either? Oh, no. Not only did he exist, he does still, and in the very job that Rimsky left, that of financial director of the Variety Theatre. About 24 hours after his visit to Voland, Aloisi came to his senses in a train somewhere near Vyatka and decided that he had left Moscow in a daze for some reason and thus had forgotten to put on his trousers. But what he couldn't understand was why he had stolen the private home builder's tenant's book, which was of absolutely no use to him. He paid the conductor a colossal sum of money for a greasy old pair of trousers and turned back at Vyatka. But alas, he could not find the private home builder's house. The dilapidated old wreck had been burned to the ground. Aloisi, however, was an extremely enterprising man. 2 weeks later, he was settled in a splendid room on Bryusov Lane, and a few months after that, he was sitting in Rimsky's office. And just as Rimsky was once tormented by Stjopa, so Varanuha is now harassed by Aloisi. Ivan Savelyevich has only one dream, namely that Aloisi be removed to some place far from the Variety and out of sight, because, as Varanuha sometimes whispers to close friends, he has never in his life met such a bastard as that Aloisi, who is capable of absolutely anything. But the manager may be prejudiced. Aloisi doesn't seem to be involved in any shady business, or in any business at all, for that matter, not counting, of course,
is appointing a new bartender to replace Sokov. Andrei Fokich died of cancer of the liver in the first clinic of Moscow University Hospital about 9 months after Volant's appearance in Moscow. Yes, several years have passed, and the events truthfully described in this book dragged on for a while and were then forgotten. But not by everyone. Not by everyone. Every year, as the spring holiday moon turns full, a man appears toward evening beneath the lindens at Patriarch's Ponds. He is a man of about 30 or so, reddish-haired, green-eyed, modestly dressed. He is a fellow of the Institute of History and Philosophy, Professor Ivan Nikolaevich Ponyryov. When he gets to the lindens, he always sits down on the same bench he was sitting on that evening when Berlioz, long forgotten by everyone, saw the moon, shattering into pieces, for the last time in his life. The now whole moon, white at the beginning of the evening and then golden, with a dark dragon horse imprinted on its face, floats above the former poet Ivan Nikolaevich, while at the same time staying in one place overhead. Everything is clear to Ivan Nikolaevich. He knows and understands everything. He knows that in his youth he was the victim of hypnotist criminals, and that he had to go in for treatment and was cured. But he also knows that there are things he cannot cope with. For example, he cannot cope with the spring full moon. As soon as it draws near, as soon as the heavenly body begins to expand and to fill with gold, just as it did long ago when it towered over the 2 5-branched candelabra, Ivan Nikolaevich becomes restless, anxious, loses his appetite, has trouble sleeping, and waits for the moon to ripen. And when the full moon comes, nothing can keep Ivan Nikolaevich at home. Towards evening, he goes out and walks to Patriarch's Ponds. Sitting on his bench, Ivan Nikolaevich openly talks to himself, smokes, and squints alternately at the moon and at the turnstile he remembers so well. Ivan Nikolaevich spends an hour or two like that. Then he gets up, and walking with vacant, unseeing eyes, always taking the same route via Spiridonovka, heads for the side streets around the Arbat. He walks past the oil shop, turns at the corner with the rickety old gas lamp, and creeps over to the fence beyond which he sees a luxuriant garden not yet in bloom and a Gothic-style house, colored by the moonlight on one side, with the bay window where the triple casements juts out, and dark on the other. The professor does not know what draws him to the fence or who lives in the house, but he does know that he cannot resist his impulses during the full moon. He also knows that in the garden beyond the fence, he will invariably see the same thing. He sees a respectable-looking, middle-aged man with a beard and a pince-nez and slightly piggish features sitting on a bench. He is a resident of the Gothic house, and Ivan Nikolaevich always finds him in the same dreamy pose, his gaze directed at the moon. Ivan Nikolaevich knows that after admiring the moon, the man on the bench will turn his gaze to the bay window and stare at it as if he expects it to burst open any minute and have something unusual appear on the windowsill. Ivan Nikolaevich knows what will happen next by heart. Here, he has to crouch down lower behind the fence, because the man on the bench will start whirling his head, trying to catch something in the air with his wandering eyes, will smile ecstatically, and then, in a kind of sweet anguish, will suddenly clasp his hands and murmur plainly and rather loudly, "Venus! Venus! Oh, what a fool I was!" "Gods! Gods!" Ivan Nikolaevich will start whispering from his hiding place behind the fence, his inflamed eyes still fastened on the mysterious stranger. "There's another victim of the moon. Yes, another one like me." And the man on the bench will continue murmuring, "Oh, what a fool I was! Why didn't I fly away with her? What was I afraid of, old ass that I am? I got a certificate, so you can suffer now, you old idiot." And so it will continue, until a window bangs open in the dark part of the house, something whitish appears, and an unpleasant female voice calls out, "Nikolai Ivanovich, where are you? What kind of craziness is this? Do you want to catch malaria? Come, have your tea." The man on the bench will, of course, then come to his senses and reply in a false tone, "Air, my darling, I just wanted a breath of air. The air is very pleasant out here." Then he gets up from the bench, shakes his fist furtively at the downstairs window as it closes, and drags himself into the house. He's lying. He's lying. "Oh, gods, how he's lying," mumbles Ivan Nikolaevich as he moves away from the fence. It's not the air that lures him into the garden at all. It's something he sees on the moon and in the garden when the spring moon is full high up above. Oh, what I'd give to learn his secret, to find out who the Venus is that he lost and now tries to catch by waving his arms pointlessly in the air. And the professor returns home, utterly ill. His wife pretends not to notice his condition and hurries him off to bed. But she herself stays up and sits by the lamp with a book, gazing at him with bitter eyes as he sleeps. She knows that at dawn, Ivan Nikolaevich will wake up with a tortured scream, and that he will start crying and toss about. That is why she keeps a hypodermic syringe soaking in alcohol on a cloth beneath the lamp in front of her, and an ampoule filled with something the color of strong tea. Tied to a gravely ill man, the poor woman will then be free and can go to sleep without any misgivings. After his injection, Ivan Nikolaevich will sleep until morning, and he will look happy as he dreams rapturous and happy dreams she knows nothing about. It is always the same thing that causes the scholar to wake up on the night of the full moon and to let out a pitiful scream. He sees an unnatural, noseless executioner leap up with a hoot and put a spear into the heart of Gestas, who is tied to a post and has lost his reason. But the most terrifying thing in the dream is not so much the executioner as the unnatural light coming from the storm cloud that is seething and pressing down on the earth, such as only happens during world catastrophes. After the injection, everything the sleeper sees changes. A broad path of moonlight stretches from his bed to the window, and heading up this path is a man in a white cloak with a blood-red lining who is walking toward the moon. Walking beside him is a young man in a torn chiton with a disfigured face. The two of them are engaged in heated conversation, arguing about something, and trying to reach some kind of agreement. "Gods! Gods!" says the man in the cloak as he turns his haughty face to his companion. "What a vulgar and banal execution! But please..." Here his face turns from being haughty to imploring. "Tell me it didn't really happen. I beg you, tell me it didn't happen, did it?" "Of course it didn't happen," answers his companion in a hoarse voice. "You only imagined it." "And you can swear to that?" asks the man in the cloak in an ingratiating way. "I can," replies his companion, his eyes smiling for some reason. "I don't need anything else.
cries out the man in the cloak in a broken voice as he ascends higher and higher toward the moon, taking his companion with him. Walking behind them, calm and majestic, is a huge dog with pointed ears. Then the path of moonlight starts frothing, and a river of moonlight gushes forth and spreads out in all directions. The moon rules and plays. The moon dances and romps. Then a woman of matchless beauty emerges from the stream and walks toward Ivan, leading a man by the hand who has an overgrown beard and is looking about fearfully. Ivan Nikolaevich recognizes him immediately. He is number 118, his night visitor. In his sleep, Ivan stretches his arms out to him and asks avidly, "So that was how it ended?"
"Yes, it was, my disciple," replies number 118.
And the woman comes over to Ivan and says, "Of course, everything ended, and everything ends. And I'm going to kiss you on the forehead, and everything will work out as it should." She leans over Ivan and kisses him on the forehead. And Ivan stretches toward her and stares into her eyes. But she draws back and walks off with her companion toward the moon. Then the moon goes on a rampage. It hurls streams of light directly at Ivan, sprays light in all directions. A moonlight flood begins to inundate the room. The light sways, rises higher, and drowns the bed. Only then does Ivan Nikolaevich sleep with a look of happiness on his face. The next morning, he wakes up silent, but completely calm and well. His ravaged memory quiets down, and no one will trouble the professor until the next full moon. Neither the noseless murderer of Gestas, nor the cruel fifth procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate.
The End. You've been listening to The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, in a translation by Diana Bergen and Catherine Tiernan O'Connor, narrated by George Guidel and directed by Greta Byram. We conclude this book with the biographical note on author Mikhail Bulgakov. Mikhail Afanasyevich Bulgakov was born in Kiev in 1891, the son of a Russian lecturer in theology and the grandson of priests on both sides. Medicine, religion, and education were the dominant careers in his family. Despite an early interest in literature and the theater, Bulgakov chose to become a doctor. In 1914, as a medical student, he volunteered with the Red Cross during World War I. After graduating from the University of Kiev in 1916, he served in the White Army during the Civil War and was briefly forcibly mobilized by the Ukrainian Nationalist Army. These experiences during the chaos of the Civil War in Kiev and the Caucasus had a profound effect on the writer and his work. His two younger brothers disappeared during the fighting around Kiev and later surfaced in Europe. In 1919, while in the Caucasus, he made the decision to leave medicine for literature. Soon after, he almost emigrated, but was prevented from doing so by illness, which he took as a sign. By 1921, he was in Moscow, where his literary career began in earnest. The Diaboliad collection, published in 1925, was his major publication of this time, since his masterpiece, Heart of a Dog, could not get past the censorship. This same period saw the partial publication of his novel about Kiev during the Civil War, White Guard. Publication ceased when the journal serializing the novel was shut down. However, enough had come out to arouse the interest of the Moscow Art Theatre, which commissioned a play based on White Guard. This play, The Days of the Turbans, was the source of Bulgakov's fame for the rest of his life, and was a major sensation both due to its vivid characterizations and its portrayal of a monarchist family in a sympathetic light, rather than as monsters, which was the norm at this time. When he had a number of other plays in production,